accession number 23818, Reel 6.
Commander Easton, Reel 6. When you got to HMS Malabar at Bermuda, did you get a proper compass or proper compass? Did you get a magnetic compass fixed? Because I'm not. Did you use two compasses after that?
We were surprised and delighted to find in the naval stores there a complete magnetic compass fitted in its binnacle, ready for hoisting on board. The dockyard carpenters made the necessary wooden plinth and so on. We went to sea to adjust it, which one has to do. And then we had our standby direction.
Which would you use normally then? I mean,
the gyro compass all the time.
So in good weather or reasonable weather, it was all right, was it?
It was all right, but obviously completely unacceptable as it was.
Were adaptations made to it?
No, I don't think that could be done. Its fault was the whole of the vital part of its works, which is called the sensitive element. That's the part that actually points to north with rotors, a very, very complex thing. Floated in a bowl of mercury about as big as a cook's big pudding bowl. And it floated in this, gently restrained, so it didn't touch anything. But the violent motion that we had when the ship pounded down, it was apt to squirt the mercury out. And so that was really incurable, and I couldn't spend just time putting it back with teaspoons.
Now, what about the working up trials? What do you remember of them? Firstly, what part were you involved in?
Well, navigation all the time, getting the ship to sea, getting her back again. It was quite a lot of exercising with a submarine. There was a target submarine there, which, having been given its preset orders, would submerge, go along certain courses, towing behind it what we call the buffs, which are little marker buoys, so you could, when you got close enough, see where the submarine was, and you would spend the day attacking the submarine. It's just a matter of acquiring the practice. This works up the command team, the captain, in the handling of the ship, and it particularly works up the ratings operating the then called ASDIC, now called sonar, detecting the submarine, keeping in touch with it. Matter of constant practice.
Anything else you recall? Any other types of working up trials, or was that the main thing?
Well, I think there was a little bit of gunnery. There was a target produced from time to time.
Who was your gunnery officer? I did forget to ask that.
Oh, yes. There was another, at least one more seaman officer, a sub-lieutenant or lieutenant. One of the other seaman officers was Gordon Patterson, sub-lieutenant, RNVR.
What was he like?
Oh, splendid man. Yes, great. Still alive. There was another officer who was on general watchkeeping duties and was the sort of secretarial man, who we call the correspondence officer. I don't remember the correspondence officer's name. I believe he died last year, 2001.
And Patterson was the gunnery officer?
Yes.
That was his role, was it?
Yes. It was not a complex job, but it was his, yes.
What did it entail, roughly speaking?
Connected to his gun's crews by telephone headset or just by shouting, depending rather upon the weather conditions, he would give them their orders and direct them as to all the normal things of loading and opening fire, trying to to correct their aim.
Do you remember the abandoned ship exercise that they had there?
I know that we would have done one, but I dare say, being navigator, it would have been a time when I could nip below and get up with my chart corrections.
Now, what about your relationship with the... Sure, there's some joking in the account that has been provided for of the Carla by Harrowfine about the relationship between Davidson and the people ashore, the officers ashore.
Oh, constant battle.
What was all that about?
Largely about the disposal of rubbish, or gash as we call it, where there was a running battle with the dockyard bosun about that. Not exactly earth-shaking.
I mean, what was the nature of it? What did he want you to do with your rubbish, and what did you want to do with it? You see what I mean?
Yes. Well, I honestly can't remember. No. It was no big deal, but it was when and where it was put ashore, and in what state it would have been. And there was 101 little things to do with them. To Jimmy Davidson's eye, interfering with his organisation of the ship's company, and then wanting it done somewhere else, done somehow else. He, being a very strong-minded man, it was not easy to make him change his mind.
And did you get ashore much? What was it like when you got ashore? Did you?
Not really, no. One was at sea every day. There was a little canteen ashore. There's nowhere else to go because the naval base is quite isolated. There's no sort of hinterland of civilization. Nothing to do. Complete isolation.
You didn't ever get into St. George's?
I went to St. George's once. I think Huckle and I went together. We must have got some kind of local road transport, I guess. Don't remember a lot about it.
Was it a friendly reception from the local British community?
Absolutely. I don't think our presence disturbed matters very much ashore, quite honestly. There were American ships in another harbour about 2 or 3 miles down the coast. It was an American base. So there was them as well. We never actually came across them. I think everyone was so busy, you just did your stuff, took your ship to sea and came back again. But we were there an awful long time. We were there 12 weeks. And the usual time was, I think, 6.
Why were we there so long?
Because we were waiting for a task to usefully employ us on the way home. In fact, the forming up of a convoy.
So what mission did they send you on? What convoy did they put you with?
Having called at Norfolk, Virginia...
This is when you left Bermuda in September.
Yes. We had a reasonable passage up there, no problems. We were sent to a port in a harbour in Newfoundland called Argentia. It was an American naval base.
Were you on your own during this period, or were you escorting the Victorias up to Argentia? There seems to be some doubt about this.
Can't recall, but either way, we would have been close together. We might have been escorting. I don't remember. Sorry.
So what happened from Argentia?
There for just a few days, where we found some British destroyers, so the O class. In due course, we sailed, found we were escorting a convoy. Victorious was there as well. Across the Atlantic.
Do you remember anything about that crossing?
No, I don't. It must have been very uneventful. There was certainly no... I don't recall any scares. I think we probably routed fairly far north, being August, September, before the winter set in. And we ended up in Belfast, which was to be our base for the rest of the ship's life.
Now, you were based at Pollock Dock, I believe.
Yes.
Could you give us a description of the environs of Pollock Dock? And I think the Caroline was near, the old the derelict-like cruiser.
We went to our Belfast lock, which is quite a large expanse of water. Up the far end is Belfast itself, and a channel leads in past the big shipyards. A channel was marked with big stakes in those days, up to a long jetty, which was called Pollock Dock, that's where. That was an operating base. The headquarters ship called HMS Caroline was lying afloat in a dock close by. Caroline was one of the very earliest aircraft carriers. Not a ship with a flight deck, but with cranes fitted for carrying aircraft, lifting in and out aircraft. And she started life as this and was then a cruiser and out of service a long time ago. HMS Caroline, where there was a captain and staff and various backup you need to operate a group of warships, including medical staff. In fact, there's an old officer called Bill Forrest, Surgeon Rear Admiral, brackets D for dental. Forrest, still alive in Petersfield. He was the dental officer. But he's of some age now.
When you got there, I think there was an almost immediate refit where various British British element was introduced into the ships. What do you remember of this refit?
Well, I remember I mentioned the domestic arrangements for the troops, the heads were converted to British standards. In other words, putting doors on the cubicles.
Ships didn't have any ward or carpet or anything else, and I believe that the wardrooms were made more comfortable.
I'm sure there were a lot of little improvements, both to the officers' quarters and the mess decks. I'm afraid I can't give any details of that. But one most important thing was, to our joy, the proper British Sperry gyroscope was fitted at the very outset, and that was perfect.
Now, what was so much better about the British
Sperry? Although an American firm, basically, the Sperry's was
Sperry.
Sperry gyro.
What was so much better about it?
It was designed for its job, much more robust than the Arma Gyro, ARMA Gyro, fitted universally throughout British warships, and it never gave us a moment of trouble.
Now, you were to join the 4th Escort Group under Shabazz. Yes.
Yes.
I think Noel Shabazz. I've forgotten his photo, but what was your relationship like with the other ships of the 4th Escort Group, who were also captain class?
Yes. 4th Escort Group, they fell into two halves. The turbo electric ships, where the power was produced in steam boilers, drove turbines, drove generators, powered electric motors, away went the ship, and diesel electric, where the power was produced by diesel engines to generators, to the ship's own motors.
And the Caldo was
turbo electric. They're a little bit bigger, and they're about 10 feet longer, a little bit faster, 24 knots as opposed to 19. So we had three of each. The only advantage of the turbo is the diesels have a longer range, more economical. Otherwise, they were the same in function. The escort force commander, as you say, Shabazz, was in the Bentinck.
What did you think of him? Or I mean, did you have much contact with him?
As a young sub lieutenant then of only 19 years. Not a lot. I mean, actually, I recognised him, but he was only on board us briefly from time to time.
What was the perception of him? Was he considered tactically astute and a good leader? Or
I would think so. Yes, I would think so. Yes, never heard a word against him. He had a small staff covering. He had a radio officer and a submarine officer to help all the other five ships of the group. There was ashore a anti-submarine trainer, which was good. It could simulate detection and hunting of a submarine on a big table.
How did it work? Did you have a go?
Yes, it worked. Fascinating. Oh.
Well, what do you remember of it?
Well, you would be. Say you were being exercised, you'd have the captain himself would be there, the navigator would be there, anti-submarine control officer there, the anti-submarine, the Aztec crew would be there, just like an aircraft simulator, you could do almost anything with it. You could be steering a certain course and speed. And it'll be represented on a big plotting table, a line going along. You could change courses and change speeds. You had your Aztec pinging away, searching for the submarine. In due course, you'd get a contact, the echo would come back, and you would go to the hunting procedures. And you would maneuver your ship and give the necessary orders for the deployment of weapons as you did so. And in the end, they could assess quite accurately how successful you would have been.
Now, the first real action that you took place in seems to have been when, in November you sailed and joined the convoy SL-139, going across the Bay of Biscay.
Yes.
This was sort of part of what they call the Bay Offensive. It was supposed to be one of the last big clashes between a U-boat pack and an escort group. What do you remember of that convoy in, mid-November, 21st November onwards?
I'm not sure we ever saw the convoy. We were acting as what was called a support group. We were tactically placed some distance away. We were further into the Bay of Biscay to meet submarines before they got near the convoy. So, whole aim being to keep them away from the convoy. Weather was fine, there we were. This was the time when the U-boats were virtually beaten. The Battle of the Atlantic was almost over. But the Germans were developing flying bombs, which were carried in large bombers, Heinkel 177s, and Dornier 17s, I think they were, big jobs, based at Brest or nearby. They had these flying bombs.
These were the glider bombs.
Glider bombs, yes. They carried the glider bombs either under each wing or else in the fuselage. On sighting you, they'd turn up onto a parallel course about a mile or two away, and in due course release a glider bomb at you, which was self-propelled with its rocket engine, controllable from the aircraft. Pretty nasty. We had one fired at us, much to our surprise. But it landed in the sea, about 100 yards short.
Where were you? Your action station. Where were you?
I was up on the bridge. We most of us were enjoying the sunshine, just sitting around.
And so you weren't at action station, too?
Yes, but until the aircraft appeared, there was nothing to get so particularly worried about. I think when the aircraft was sighted, the ship went to action stations and we were firing at it, but it was too far away initially. Didn't hurt it. The Beaufort was fine. You could see the tracer sort of going up past it, but it really was too far away to have much of a hope of hitting.
Did the ship take evasive action, or?
Yes, the captain did. I think he, as far as I recall, turned away and increased speed, but it was all over in a matter of, a half a minute.
Did you know what it was that was radar controlled, or?
Yes, I mean, we knew about these things, and. Suddenly realised we were a target. And if it had been properly aimed and controlled, it would have done for us.
Now, so what was your action station? Perhaps we ought to look at this. I mean, you've
got... I was on the bridge, or in the chart room directly below.
Now, what would you do? What was your role in action stations? What were you doing?
At that time, nothing in particular.
No, I mean generally when you were at action stations.
Advising the captain, discussing the situation with the captain. There'd be other officers there as well, and down below in the chart house, operating the ship's plot, which is the pencil representation of the ship's track, That's where Harold 5 was too, and the radar.
Could you explain a bit about the plot as on that? I know we've talked about the plot before, but the plot on the Calder, what level of sophistication had that got to?
As fitted, we had an American plot and an American log. The log being the instrument which sticks out of the bottom of the ship and measures the ship's speed. The American log was not suitable for us, again, because the ship moved too much and it couldn't cope with the being exposed to the air, then dive back in the water again as the ship pitched. And fitted up initially at bridge level, vertically, just in front of the what's called the compass platform, where the captain is and the stand controlling the ship, little compartment in front of that. So it was presented to you as a big vertical sheet of paper, underneath which crawled a device which moved, its direction being guided by the gyro compass, and its speed being guided by the ship's log. So when it set to the appropriate scale, it was a constant recording of the ship's position as a little line. But being vertical, every time in rough weather, when the ship bumped heavily, the sensitive parts of the plotting table, which were all counterbalanced with springs, which held their weight, would drop down, and it couldn't stand the motion. In other words. So when we got back to Belfast, that was another thing that was changed. A British plotting table was put in the chart house down below, and a British log was fitted, married up with a British gyro, and things were much better then. So in there, in the chart room, we had the plotting table with your track being automatically recorded. Information from the Aztec as to where the submarine was, bearing so and so, say bearing 130, 5,000 yards, whatever it was, and then that would be plotted on the table. So in due course, you were generating a line showing your own track and the submarine's track, hopefully. And there's quite a lot. There was a full-time job for an officer to advise the captain as to the courses to steer to get into the right position for attacking the submarine, reading off what the submarine's course and speed was, in fact telling him what instruments were telling me down below on the plotting table.
Now, anything else about this sort of distant escort? I understand what you mean about the SR-13. Now, as far as you remember, ever saw it, but there were quite a lot of submarine contacts which didn't necessarily come to fruition at that time. Do you remember much about shaking down into this sort of role? Or anything that happened in that?
One was, as a matter of routine, constantly vigilant for submarine contacts, listening for the telltale echo, assessing it as a submarine or non-sub. There were plenty of non-sub echoes. It could be a whale, a big shoal of fish, or some other change in water conditions, which would at first appear to be a submarine, and further examination would indicate not so.